All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We got some things to talk about on the show today. Doesn't look like we're going to have any interviews. Actually, that might not be right. We might have some interviews, but I don't know. You know what I think? I'd like to take some phone calls. We got a lot to talk about, and I actually want to know what you guys think about some things. Obviously, the big news is Ferguson and the big no bill for Darren Wilson, the murderer. There's that. And then, of course, there's the wars. There's Rand Paul's declaration of war. Obama's escalation of the Afghan war. And, of course, the new debate over the new incoming Secretary of Defense, who that'll be, what happened to the old one. So, I think it'd be interesting later on in the show to maybe take some calls. Oh, and Israel news. This is one of the invites that I have out today is to Jason Ditz from antiwar.com. I don't want to go too far off into a tangent. Warning, that usually means I'm about to. But I really would prefer to save this for the interview and have him really explain it. There are two major things at issue here, legally speaking, in Israel. One is the bill to define Israel as a Jewish state in law, which in effect means... Well, I don't know. We'll let Jason explain. And then the other one is about seizing the property of, quote, bad people. Really. Bad people and their relatives. So we don't know exactly what that even means, but anyway. I think we have a pretty good idea. And with the end of the pretension of the so-called peace process. Did I turn the ringer off? That doesn't turn the vibrator thing off, too? What the hell? That just goes to show that, Israel is a fascist state. It's an apartheid state where the minority rules the majority. And, you know, people for years have warned, including Ehud Barak, the former prime minister, that, you know, we keep on like this, we can either be a Jewish state or a democratic state, but not both. And the only reason they could get away with that in the first place was because they had expelled all the Palestinians, all the Muslims and Christians who lived there for not being Jewish. So they had their 80-20 monopoly. But then comes the occupation, occupying all those refugees that they kicked out of the rest of Israel. So now they've taken that population again. But the pretense has been, well, it's only very long-term, temporarily occupied territory that someday will be given up to be Palestine. But now that that pretense is over, what do you got? Roughly a 50-50 split. Maybe, if not already, soon enough, 51-49, more Palestinian Muslims and Christians than Jewish Israelis. Living under the domination of the Israeli government, its police, its military, its Knesset, that the Palestinians can't vote in, have no say in. Separate is inherently unequal, and here it's not even de facto. It's meant to be that way. It's apartheid. That's what it is. It's a crime from morning to night, day in, day out. That's what it is. Just no denying it. And so what do? They just keep doubling down. They got a bunch of Republicans, basically the Likud party of Israel. They're the Republicans. And like Republicans, they're horrible bastards. And so all they keep doing is making everything worse and worse and worse. It's just incredible what goes on over there. Seriously. You're going to revoke residency and seize property from, quote, bad people. Now, I mean, the law in America... The so-called rule of law is a joke. But I don't think they try to pass laws like that, do they? You ever heard of that? A law where you're going to strip citizenship, residency, property rights from people for being bad people? Not punishing them for a bad thing, but for being bad people. All right. I mean, what the hell, right? It's not like Israel is a Western democracy. It's much more a Middle Eastern dictatorship type of a country, like Saudi Arabia or the Islamic State. It's a right-wing theocracy. As Rabbi Kahane put it, controversial back then in the 1980s, might have even been the 70s. I remember this clip of the Rabbi Kahane telling Morley Safer from 60 Minutes, "Hey, look, man, I'm not Thomas Jefferson, okay? And I'm not pretending to be Thomas Jefferson. I don't believe in the Enlightenment. I don't believe in individualism. This is about my tribe versus everybody else. And screw you. And I'm glad you don't like it, too." You know, that was actually the first proto-Al-Qaeda attack in America, was they assassinated that bastard in New York City. And then the DOJ prosecuted it as a lone wolf attack, even though, no, it wasn't. It was Egyptian Islamic Jihad. But anyway. Yeah, and their failure on that assassination helped lead directly to the first World Trade Center bombing. Anyway, read Peter Lance. That's the whole thing. Anyway, that was controversial back then when Rabbi Kahane said it. Now that's just official centrist Israeli policy. We're stealing the West Bank. We're stealing it because we want it. And the Palestinians who live there, they can all go to hell because we don't care about them. Okay. As long as you're being open and honest about it. And, you know, I don't know, man. I don't mean to be hypocritical. I guess I could mention that, yeah, the Americans deny, the U.S. government denies the property rights of the American Indians all day, every day. I just saw an article yesterday that said that most American youngsters entering into college, they don't even know that there's such a thing as an Indian anywhere in America at all anymore. As far as they know, Indians ceased to exist after 1900. They just killed all of them. And yeah, what were you going to do? You know, there's an inevitable kind of kill them all kind of a thing. They went and surveyed the textbooks. Only one state, I think it was Washington State or Oregon, I guess, had the word genocide in it. But yeah, you know, Oklahoma isn't Indian territory anymore, is it? And no, they're not all dead, but almost. And of all the different nations that used to exist here, I mean, are there any Comanche left anywhere? The Comanche are all dead, right? I don't know. I'm no master of the history of the Indian Wars or anything, but at least, you know, this is something I talked about with Max Blumenthal years ago about when he was, you know, just beginning to write his book, Goliath, in Israel there, was that Israel's just like America, with the whole Manifest Destiny and all the rest of that crap, you know, America from the 1900s. Only the thing of it is that now in late 20th and 21st century America, the consensus, I believe, is, damn, that's pretty regretful. That was a wrong thing. That's like slavery and oppression of, you know, denial of women's property rights and you know, all the other injustices that we continue to fail but try to correct here in America, you know? That's one of the things that we look back on and say, man, that was wrong. All that self-congratulatory Manifest Destiny, screw them for being in our way. That's something we regret now. Well, then why do we back that exact same policy in Israel and Palestine right now of the Israelis over the Palestinians? As though they're just Indians and nits make lice and go ahead and kill them all and take their land. I thought we were against that. Now. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this, Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm a Scott Horton. Yeah, I suck at radio. I'm a suck at radio, but I'm good on everything, man. So, we compromise. You settle. I can't talk good, but you can understand what I mean, despite that fact, and then you agree with all of it because I'm perfect. I mean, on the issues. I'm a terrible person. I just mean, on the issues, I'm perfect. All right, call in the show if you want to call in. Obviously, the big news is cops can kill whoever they want, including Mike Brown. But I'm interested in if you guys think you got some insight you want to share with us, dude. I'll hear it. It's the holiday season, after all. So the call-in number is 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836. And by the way, join up the chat room. Looks like we got a pretty good crowd in the chat room today. Hey, chat room guys, how's things going, man? That's scotthorton.org/chat. So you don't need any kind of external application. Say you're at work. You don't need Chatzilla or XChat or Pigeon or any download and run any program. Just go to a plain old browser window. scotthorton.org/chat, fake name and a CAPTCHA. You're in. No problem. In fact, a lot of times the CAPTCHA is a picture of a street address or something. So it's really easy. Instead of a completely ridiculous squiggly word that you can't even read. Even if you're not a computer. but anyway. Also, it's an IRC free node chat, so if you do have all those external applications and you're a chat using IRC free node type of a person, whatever the hell that means, then you can do that too. It's hashtag Scott Horton Show. That's the chat room. And in fact, I guess what I ought to do then is I ought to copy and paste that phone number right into the chat room in case you're wondering to yourself, what did he say that phone number was again? It's 512-271-4836. And, here's a question in here. That's certainly a perfectly fine stand-in for a phone call. If you guys want to ask questions in the chat room, I'll try to keep my eyes peeled for that. Hey, Scott, is our unwavering support of Israel really the result of the Israel lobby or our desire for a beat cop in the Middle East neighborhood? Some of both. Well, if I have to sum it up, I'll say, yeah, both. Also, do you think our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq have to do with cock-blocking China from Middle East goodies? Yeah, I think if you look at the policy, it is one part profits for Houston, right? It's not like they don't have, incentives for trying to control who gets to pump the oil out of the ground. At the same time, oil companies mostly prefer stability. They can make plenty of money buying, selling, and trading, and don't really need wars. It's a kind of junior high school left-wing misnomer that the wars are fought so that the greedy American public can have cheap oil for their pickup trucks and that kind of thing. What it's really about in terms of oil is strategic dominance of the planet. Full spectrum dominance, in fact, is what they call it. That's the military speak for it. The neoconservative so-called thinkers, Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, call it benevolent global hegemony. And what it means is America will dominate all nations on the planet forever, and none of them will ever look at us funny ever. Not that that's working out very well. Of course, Iran, China, and Russia, I guess along with North Korea, not that they count for too much, but these are nations that are still independent from the influence of the American empire, and they hate that. So when it comes to what is America doing in the Middle East, what is America doing in Africa, dominating, controlling those resources, whether to keep the prices low or keep the prices high at any given time is much more of a political thing. In fact, I think I was trying to interview somebody about this, but it didn't work out, and then I kind of forgot about it. There's been a couple of good articles recently about how our lower gas prices are a conspiracy between the Americans and the Saudis to overproduce, quote unquote overproduce. It's all a cartel, so we don't know what the price would be in a free market if there was such a thing as a free market in oil. but the Saudis are producing like crazy and driving the price of oil down in order to screw the Iranians and the Russians and the Syrians. And actually, it's probably pretty good for hurting the Islamic State, too, because they already have to sell at a discount because it's, you know, black market stuff. So that's why we're benefiting by relatively lower prices at the gas pump. Nothing like the good old days before George W. Bush, but still. But then, so, yeah, what does America care about what's going on in Uganda? Keeping the Chinese out. Keeping them from having enough political stability around there. They can build a pipeline and get that oil out of there and to their markets. Same thing with dominating all the seas, too. Not for, you know, the average day, but in case there's a crisis, that they have the ability to cut off the Chinese, who have virtually no oil resources of their own, I guess. Or at least, you know, maybe some offshore, but relatively speaking to their demand, they're really dependent on imports. And so there's that. And then, oh, good, there's a caller. Hang on the line. I'll get right with you. And then the other question about Israel, I'll just sum this up. There's a very ironic and interesting article by John V. Walsh at antiwar.com a couple articles ago where he's kind of tongue-in-cheek saying how lucky we are that we have the Israelis to continue to prevent the American empire from pivoting to Asia and really picking a fight with somebody who can fight back. The Chinese, who can nuke American cities off the face of the earth if it comes down to it. And so, you know, if there's a bad and a worse policy, bad is America in the Middle East, worse is really renewing the Cold War against the Russians and the Chinese, 40 years after the end of one Cold War and 25 years after the end of the other one, which is madness. All right. So cool. Caller on the line. Hey, I'm Scott and you're on the show.
Hey, Scott, it's Fitz from San Francisco. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing real good. How are you?
Oh, fine, thanks.
Let me grab my headphones. I can hear you clear. Go ahead.
No problem. Well, I can't remember if it might have been you or some like-minded person that tweeted out a link to it last night, but I was reading, it was an old Dan, I must have a month or two old, Dana Milbank piece from WAPO on Ferguson, the prosecutor there.
Right.
It was saying how his, you know, the prosecutors, his father, mother, brother, cousins were all cops or at least worked for the police department. But I'd read this somewhere, and didn't know if you knew of this true, that prosecutor's father was a cop who was shot dead by a black guy.
That's right.
And it was just, you know, all kind of went towards his being a little bit biased. But Milbank, I think the more, you know, that's all just, you know, circumstantial. But the more important thing I think Milbank put out was that, you know, he had, I think there was only one instance, and it was a pretty, you know, out of the bounds instance of him actually prosecuting the cop or getting an indictment on a cop. And it was something like just, you know, where the guy, the cop beat his wife or something that was just, there was no way to get around it. Mm-hmm. But there, besides that, in his 20 plus years as a prosecutor, he'd only brought four indictments against cops, and none of them resulted in, four times he brought before the grand jury, and none of them resulted in an indictment.
Right. Well, and you know, geez, now the music's playing. We're going to have to take this break. Thanks very much for the call. We're going to talk about that on the other side of this.
Okay.
Thanks very much. We appreciate it. The grand jury, that's where we'll pick this up. And the prosecutor's attitude in the way that he took this case to the grand jury and the rest of Ferguson outrage for you here on the Scott Horton Show. Hang tight. And your calls. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back. Thanks, Bruisers, for the sounds. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Maybe we're going to have Jason Ditz to talk about Israel later if I'm lucky. I don't know. I really want to talk with you guys. Go ahead, call in the show if you want, man. 512-271-4836. Obviously most people, you know, have something to say about, Ferguson. You want to get that off your chest or ask a question or whatever it is, go ahead and call in. Also, I would say, we could talk about, the war and Rand Paul and, you know, whatever else is on your mind, more or less along the lines of how this show works. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, daily. Except for the rest of this week, I'm taking it off. I'm using the excuse of Thanksgiving, but actually I'm going to be working the entire time. But I've got a project that I absolutely just have to knock out, and so everybody have a happy holiday. I don't know what Ian will do, reruns or what, for the rest of the week, but I'll probably still be shouting angry things on Twitter if you just can't get enough. But anyway, so Ferguson, Fitzy G made a couple of points there, the caller, before we had to go to break, that are worth revisiting. That I was unaware of the part about the prosecutor's family, you know, kind of all being cops, but I was aware that his father was a cop who was killed in the line of duty by a black man, and also that he had wanted to be a cop, but because of an injury, he decided to become the local prosecutor instead. But it's pretty easy to see what a tight-knit community the law enforcement community, as they call themselves, in that part of Missouri are, and he's one of them. There's a clear conflict of interest, and a lot of people thought so, and simple as that. But the most revealing thing in the Dana Milbank pieces, which I recommend to you, they're old, but they're relevant for your understanding, I think, here, is that the fix is in, man. And we were always meant to. They could have charged him, and they could have just gone straight to preliminary hearings, and yes, Your Honor, this is why we think there's probable cause to pursue this, and take him to trial, and they would have done it. Most people don't get a grand jury. A grand jury, in the first place, especially when you're talking about a cop kills an unarmed, of course, well, not of course, but an unarmed black man, or really anybody else, they use the grand jury to hide behind and say, well, you know, we tried to get the grand jury, but they, you know, they didn't want to indict because they didn't think so, no. But the truth is, of course, any prosecutor can prosecute anybody he wants. He doesn't even need to take it to a grand jury. Just take it to a judge and say, hey, here's why we think there's probable cause. The guy was this far away, this, that, the other. We think we ought to let the jury sort this out. And the judge will say, okay, in the case of you killing anybody, that's how it would go. You wouldn't get a grand jury unless, you know, for some reason, it's a real hard case to make. And they want to be able to, you know, really shore up their credibility. For the most part, it's a rubber stamp, you know, for prosecutors to go after someone or to refrain to. I guess if they go after somebody who's rich and powerful, sometimes they'll use a grand jury to, you know, sort of solidify their case before they move forward to the Pettit jury. But anyway, the fix was in the first place. But then once you get to the grand jury, any prosecutor, as you'll learn in junior college or anywhere else, flipping through the channels, any prosecutor worth his salt can indict a ham sandwich. So if you've never heard that phrase before, what that means is a ham sandwich is a non-sentient being. It's sort of an inanimate object. It's sort of, and it's kind of, it's funny because a ham sandwich is kind of funny, sort of like the way a banana cream pie is funny. It's so ordinary that it's exceptional for its ordinariness. The most offensive thing about it could possibly be the spicy mustard. Or I guess if you're kosher or whatever they call kosher for Muslims, then, you know, maybe that. But anyway, if he can indict a ham sandwich, that means he can indict an innocent person if he feels like it. Any prosecutor can get any grand jury to say yes and indict anyone he wants on any day of the week. That's the conventional wisdom. It has its own cliche. Any prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. Why? Because there's no defense attorney. It's just the case that the prosecutor feels like putting to the grand jury. And the grand jury, of course, is always made up of cops' wives and retired judges and whatever. It's made up of the law enforcement community anyway. It's not we, the people. It's them, the state. They're the grand jury anyway. So they'll go along, and that's in every jurisdiction in America, okay? So they'll go along with whatever the prosecutor wants to do. In this case, the prosecutor said, hey, I'm dumping all the material on you, grand jury. You guys kind of sort it out because, hey, you know. which is sending a signal just from the very get-go, is sending a signal that I don't really see a case to pursue here. You guys decide if you see one. So already at that point, in a sense, as you can tell, the prosecutor is using his discretion to recommend to the grand jury that they do not pursue charges. And as he put it, I saw the press conference last night. I've not read through all the grand jury material, but I saw the press conference last night. And what he cites as forensic evidence, debunking testimony and whatever, is hardly conclusive. Other than if it's simply just a one-sided case with him not as a prosecutor, but as a defense attorney for the cop in front of the grand jury. It's the defense's case of what all this evidence says and means. And I'll give you the prime example of that. The blood pattern evidence on the street confirms that Mike Brown turned around. He turned around, verifying what the cop said and his fear. Well, pardon me, but the story from Mike Brown's friend that was with him, and at least some of the other witnesses who talked to the media before, was that as he was running away, Darren Wilson, the cop, kept shooting him and likely hit him again. They thought, yeah, he was shooting him in the back. He was missing. He fired 12 shots total. He hit 6 times, okay? He kept shooting as the boy was running away. Well, he was a man. He was 18 years old. Technically, he was a man. As he was running away, he kept shooting. The cop kept shooting. And so according to his friend, he turned around and said, "I give up. Stop. Hands up. Don't shoot." I don't know if that's the exact quote, "the hands up, don't shoot." But he was turning around to basically, like, you know, as he's running away, he's clearly no longer aggressing. But so he's like trying plan B, okay? Plan B is turn around and talk to the cop. "Please stop shooting me. I'm not fighting you now." Now, I'm not saying I was there and that that's 100% what happened. I'm just saying that that's consistent with the same evidence. Where the cop goes, "Yeah," and then he turned around and came at me. Well, he come at you because he was assaulting you? Or was he turning around saying, "Please stop shooting. Don't murder me. Please let me live." I don't know. I also don't know whether the guy decided, which I think would have been within his right, because I think the cops started it in the first place. They say the fact that there was a scuffle in the car, again, proves the cop's case. But no, it doesn't. The witness, his best friend, said from the beginning, he tried to open the door and slammed into Mike Brown and then tried to reach through the door and grab him. And so he was aggressing against Mike Brown, not that he was really in a position to do so, still in his truck, but he tried. And so Brown was resisting the cop's aggression. The fact that there was a scuffle doesn't prove necessarily who started it. I'm not saying I was there and I know exactly who started, but I'm just saying they cite the fact that there was a scuffle in the car as though that completely exonerates the cop's point of view and completely debunks the other side of the story. But no, it doesn't. And they don't ever prove that. They don't ever go, for example, "Here are all the people on the Mike Brown side of the story who denied that there was ever any contact within while the cop was still in the truck." Right, because that never happened. They never denied that. That was part of their story too. So you can see the prosecutor himself, the way he tells this story in front of the cameras, the same one he told to the grand jury. He's the cop's defense lawyer, spinning every little quote-unquote fact his way. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Hey, listen, I screwed up last segment. I forgot to give out the phone number. Again, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If you want to talk about Ferguson, the cops, the wars. there's so much more to talk about, but this Ferguson thing is huge. And listen, go look. I couldn't get Will Grigg on the show today. He's in the middle of writing an essay, and he just couldn't do it. But maybe I'll have him on tomorrow. I don't know. Maybe I'll interview him for the KPFK show this weekend or something. The heroic Will Grigg. But he wrote one up for Lou Rockwell's blog last night. It's called Darren Wilson and the Protocols of Official Exoneration. And this is about how he admits, Darren Wilson admits in his grand jury testimony on pages 77 and 78 that he was coached in his testimony by the Fraternal Order of Police. And that's why everything he says is a canned cliche pile of crap. About how, oh, it was like I was a 5-year-old taking on Hulk Hogan. Okay, well, you know what? I read somewhere that Mike Brown was a pretty big guy. But you know what? Darren Wilson is 6'4", also. Darren Wilson is no twerp. Darren Wilson is not a 5-year-old compared to Mike Brown in any sense. But that's clearly a practiced phrase. And then here's the best one coming up here. Melodramatic flourish, as Will Grigg calls it. Thus, we are told, when Wilson grabbed Brown's forearm through the window of his SUV, the only way I can describe it is I felt like a 5-year-old holding on to a Hulk Hogan. As Grigg points out, Wilson also stands 6'4 and weighs 210 pounds. So Brown was almost 300 pounds, but as Grigg points out, unathletic. It's not like he was all cut muscle. He was just kind of a big doughboy. You know what I mean? In terms of athletic build or unathletic build. So he was fatter. But Wilson, same height, 210 pounds, in better shape. Not so outmatched. And then, get this. This is almost unbelievable, but of course not. After being shot during the altercation in the SUV, Brown then displayed the face of, quote, a demon. A demon, Wilson claims. After fleeing from the officer, who continued to shoot at him, Brown could be seen, quote, almost, nice qualifier. Are you ready for this? Almost bulking up to run through the shots. Almost bulking up to run through the shots. Isn't that funny? Since bullets are smaller than people, typically. It's the bullet that's going through Mike Brown. What does that even mean? That he phases into some pure energy form to allow the bullets to pass harmlessly through him? Or that this almost bulking up made him bulletproof with his big, strong black guy muscles? That the bullets would then bounce harmlessly off of him? Well, that's not quite in there. Almost bulking up to run through the shots. Mm-hmm. Wilson continued, as Will Grigg characterized it, a line that doubtless reflects the verbal artistry of a well-paid police union attorney. You have a gun. He doesn't. He's 135 feet away. Not 35. It was 128 or something. And all day long on CNN, well, he did turn around. The blood evidence proves that he turned around. Yes, yeah, so what? What does that prove? And so, in fact, here's another little side rant on CNN's coverage this morning. And, you know, these are just hacks and idiots in front of a camera, and they're doing their best live, maybe, but anyway. So the lady says, I'm concerned when I read the transcript, they didn't really cross-examine Wilson at all. They totally just take his word for everything and just skate right on. It's a little disturbing to me that they don't push back on anything he says. They don't follow up anything he says with, well, wait a minute, what about this? Or say again, or nothing. Just, oh, okay, whatever you say, Darren, is the whole damn thing. And then they say, well, what about that, right-wing apologist for the government? And then, so right-wing apologist for the government says, well, that's the thing about the forensic evidence, is that it's pure science, math, facts, and it is not subject to spin or interpretation. It's not? And then, what's his next sentence? Pure spin and interpretation. Well, the fact that the blood shows that he stopped and started coming back the other way, and then he even qualifies it. It doesn't say whether he was running, whether he was walking, whether he was stumbling. He concedes that. But the fact that the blood shows that he was coming around the other way, that verifies then what Darren Wilson was saying, that he was charging at him and he was afraid for his life. Yeah, but you just conceded that it doesn't even necessarily imply that in the middle of your sentence. One big sentence with a phrase in the middle broken off by commas that completely contradicts the rest of it. Or actually it goes, assertion, contradiction, contradiction of that assertion, and then contradiction. Wait, you guys do the math on the damn thing. The fact that there's blood on the street is not open to interpretation. It's only a pure fact that proves the cop's case. By the way, it really doesn't show whether he was running or stumbling or what. And whose word is it that he was charging? Do we know that yet? Was that one of the witnesses that says he was charging? Or is that the cop's word? Is that the prosecutor's word? And what exactly does charging mean? You know what? I went to junior high school psychology class, okay? And so I can tell you, and you already know this, right? If you ask someone, if you show them a picture of a car crash, and then you ask them, how fast do you think those cars were going when they crashed? They will give you a faster speed than if you say when they collided or when the accident occurred. If you say crashed, you get 10 more points. You get 10 more miles per hour. If you say crashed, they are then 100% more likely to believe that they remember broken glass in the picture, whether or not there was really broken glass. In other words, it's all in the question. The power of suggestion in the question is perfectly there. So, of course, the DA's explanation for all of this is everybody who takes Mike Brown's side, quote unquote, in their explanation of what happened. Any inconsistency at all between any of them proves that they're all completely full of it. And since we like the cops, then any of the so-called science only proves what the cops say it proves. And never mind whether it's consistent with what any of the other witnesses said. Because, and I admit I haven't been following this case as closely as some, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone deny that Mike Brown ran and then turned around. That is not in dispute. That is not in dispute. All of the original things were, yeah, and then he was like stumbling down to his knees with his hands up and he was still getting shot. And as he fell forward dying, he took one more to the top of his dome. That wasn't a bull charge. That was a man dying, falling dead to the ground, falling terribly wounded to the ground, and then got one more fatal shot to the top of his head. No one said, yep, and then he just kept running, and the cop shot him only in the back. That was no one's narrative. But anyway, the fact that he turned around, oh, that only proves what the cops say. Lord have mercy if someone kills you and it's up to the government to decide who did it and up to a bunch of jurors to decide who to indict, who to convict. They're probably more likely to just continue perpetuating violence against the innocent as do anything right.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like I said, tomorrow, Will Grigg will be on the show to tell us what's really up with all this. But I want to point out that cops kill people all the time. All the time. And just 2 days ago, the cops killed a 12-year-old boy in Cleveland, Ohio, who had a BB gun. And the white man who called 911 in the first place said it's probably a fake gun. Said that twice. Supposedly, the 911 dispatcher didn't bother to mention that part to the cops. But, of course, if he thought it was a fake gun, then why did this idiot call the pigs in the first place? And then, according to the little girl eyewitness, she said, the boy said to the cop, look, it's not real. Or it's fake and it doesn't have bullets. And he just lifted up his shirt to show them the gun. Or, you know, maybe he was just taking it out to show it to them. Because how could a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun imagine that the cop is going to murder him? He goes to lift up his shirt and the cop just murders him. This happens daily. You know, there are 100 SWAT raids a day in this country. Wait, no, it's 50 a day or something. There's SWAT raids like crazy. People getting shot by cops like crazy. So what is significantly different about the Mike Brown thing? As people have pointed out, he wasn't the greatest poster child for this. Apparently, he was a bully and supposedly he had stolen some Swisher Sweets or something. I don't know. He looks kind of mean in all his pictures. He's not the greatest poster boy for innocent, unarmed black guy killed by the cops, but close enough, he was unarmed. He was a considerable distance from the cop who shot 12 bullets at him. But anyway, so why is this one so captivating? Why has this one grabbed the attention of so many people when cops execute people daily? Especially blacks, but whites too. You know, we talked last week about whites and blacks. It's so funny to talk like that. White people too. A white girl who, if she had gone missing in Aruba, would have been on our news for 3 years in a row. Pretty, blonde hair, blue eyes. She's leaving a party where kids are drinking. She's like 18, 19, 20. In other words, it's ridiculous that it's supposedly a crime for her to be drinking anyway. So the cops come and break up the party. She's trying to leave. And the cop's own video shows that he races to run and get in front of her car. Then claims she's trying to run him down. Jumps on her hood and shoots her to death. 4 times straight through the windshield. Kills her. And the grand jury no-billed him, too. Cops get away with killing people all the time. So what was... Now, the one in Walmart where the guy had a BB gun in the Walmart, that was also one where it was... The headline was so strange. Shoots a guy who's buying a BB gun from the Walmart. It's like he brought his own BB gun from home. He was buying it off the shelf at the damned Walmart. And the cops came in and executed him. Well, murdered him. And actually scared an innocent bystander lady nearby right out of her life. Gave her a heart attack. She dropped dead right there on the ground. Out of fear for the cops. Murdering the man next to her. Really? Nobody ever said boo about her. This poor woman who dropped dead of fright of these assassins. But anyway, I'm going to get to answering my rhetorical question now. The answer is, why it became such a big deal is because when they left his body out there in the street in the hot sun for 4 hours and people started gathering around, when the cops then panicked and they called out their entire arsenal of, you know, one day when the economy really collapses and they go to total war against all of us type, you know, gear that they've been saving up. And they went and got all of it. They came out and in effect said, you N-words have a problem with what we did to the one of you? You just wait. And they came out with all their M-wraps and their M4 machine guns and all their camouflage and armor. You had guys from the U.S. Army infantry laughing and mocking these cops, saying, man, I went toe-to-toe with Al-Qaeda in Ramadi and I didn't dress up like that, you cowards. But anyway, they came out with their full paramilitary wannabe Delta Force gear and threat, in other words, in plain English, threatening the lives of any of the other black people in town who had a problem with what they'd done to Mike Brown. Pointing their sniper rifles right at him, spraying him with poison gas. You got a problem with it? What? And then they called out everything they had. Everyone, put on your military uniforms. Everybody, get your sniper rifle and your M4, which that's just a M16, but they cut the barrel shorter so it fit in a aluminum Humvee when they send your cousin out to get killed patrolling the Iraqis in an aluminum Humvee. At least, you know, after a while, they figured out the M16's barrel is too damn long. These guys are getting stuck in the aluminum Humvee death trap when they're trying to get out of it. Anyway, and I'm not a gun expert, but I'm pretty sure otherwise it's just the same thing. 3-shot burst. It's just an M16, right? An M4, M16 with a shorter barrel. Maybe a gun nut in the, in the chat room can help verify that. But anyway, that was what was so special about the murder of Mike Brown, is the way all the cops reacted to anyone who wanted to dare protest about it. And that was the huge crisis. It's the same thing with the Branch Davidians, like I try to point out. They do Waco-style raids on people all day, every day. The only thing that was special about the Branch Davidians is there were so many of them in one place. And when the cops showed up to shoot them all to death, there were enough able-bodied males with rifles who were able to rally and shoot back and drive the attackers away. Which led, and then of course you have the whole religious, end times thing and the made for TV drama of the siege and all of that. But otherwise, you know, if they had the element of surprise and they'd just gone in there and killed Koresh and 4 or 5 women and children, in the initial raid, and the whole thing had been over on the first day, Waco wouldn't have even been that big of a deal. Yeah, it was another paramilitary police raid where the cops kill some people. And then the grand jury says, we don't care about that. Go ahead and kill whoever you want. So that's what people need to realize. There are a few of these that really capture the headlines, that capture the imagination. You would think that this 12-year-old boy, maybe his murder has been overshadowed by the Mike Brown thing. There are a few of these that drive headlines, but this happens every day. You know, in Austin, Texas, I saw some stats that unfortunately didn't include the year 2000 and 2001. I happen to remember the cops killed a lot of people in Austin, Texas in 2000 and 2001. I'll never forget this one guy. He was so retarded. He was a mental 2 or 3-year-old. He was like a tiny child. He was afraid because a fire engine drove by. And the bright lights and sound of the siren had just spooked him and set him off. So he was running down Riverside Drive in his underwear in a panic because he was afraid of a fire truck. And a cop came and killed him. It's like killing a baby. The cop could have pushed him down. The guy picked up a stick from the ground. In the newspaper, it turned into a branch. Oh, he wielded a branch! The 3-year-old baby. And it's not like he's in a giant's body or anything either. He was just a regular-sized guy. Afraid of a fire truck. And that's just one of dozens and dozens from my town. What about in your town? Somebody on Twitter challenged me. They kill someone every day. Prove it. I went and found him 5 links. Here you go. Nate Silver, 538, Statistician of the Year of the Decade.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Someone I otherwise like and respect is writing on Twitter right now that gun control is the only answer to the problems that face us. Wait, what? Only cops should have guns? That's the lesson here? Pardon me, I don't follow. Anyway. Yeah, it just goes to show, people believe whatever they want, man. You know, and believe whatever they feel like. All right. If you guys want to talk more about this Ferguson thing, I had some more things to say about it, but I'm going to go ahead and leave it alone for now, I guess. I don't know what else to say. But if you guys want to call in the show, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Also, you can drop by the chat room. You want to ask me questions in there or make a comment or anything like that. ScottHorton.org/chat. Well, that's pretty good. By the way, did you hear the Patrick Hoburn interview yesterday? Stop by ScottHorton.org if you didn't. It was a really good one. And, you know, Patrick Hoburn, he's always really good, but it was really something else. All right. So far, I haven't heard back from Jason Ditz. Sorry about that. I was hoping to interview him about these new Israeli laws, but we'll get to that. Let me talk a little bit about Patrick Hoburn and what he said in that interview about the Islamic State being like a bunch of Nazis. In fact, the way he phrased it was, you know, there's always a bunch of talk about whoever is the, you know, designated enemy, you know, or compared to the Nazis. But geez, in this case, they really are Nazis. Well, so he's right. People have absolutely used and abused that phrase to death, especially the U.S. Empire, in describing its enemies and why we have to go start wars now. It's because they're so bad that they're Hitler. Manuel Noriega is Hitler. What are you going to do? Let him conquer all of Eastern Europe? Kill 25 million Russians? So, or whatever. So, that's how they do it. But then, so Coburn says, but you know, these Islamic State guys, they are like Nazis. They're completely fanatical. They're completely bigoted. They mass murder and rape, and enslave people, literally. They come into town, they execute civilians. I guess they take prisoners only where they can make ransom or they need to hold somebody for blackmail. Otherwise, they just shoot all their prisoners in the head. Go look on Live League. Watch them massacring parking lots full of bound men. Just machine gunning them all to death. And so the thing of it is that here's the big difference. And I really should have followed up with Patrick about this, too. Because I think I got a pretty good understanding of what he's saying. But then again, they could be his words could be misinterpreted, or I don't know exactly what he meant. But I don't think he's justifying war, like using that talking point to say, well, this one really is like the Islamic State, like Hitler, like the Nazis. So therefore, we need to go ahead and launch this war. He's not saying that. He was making a more limited point about, yeah, these guys are a bunch of fanatical murderers. They're complete sickos. And yeah, they enslave people and brag about it. A literal chattel slavery and mass rapes and murders and everything else, beheadings. They're sickos. They're like the Khmer Rouge, maybe, if you like that better. But now the thing of it is, they got the crappiest part of Iraq, okay? They don't own Germany, which happens to be some pretty prime real estate there in Western and Central Europe. They're not the Nazis inheriting the most powerful, the most advanced, technological, mechanized state on the planet. They've got no man's land. They've got empty desert. They've got you can have it land in the worst part of Iraq. So, yeah, they do, threaten the Mosul Dam. And yeah, you know, they're basically claiming territory on the Tigris and the Euphrates, but only kind of in a straight line. You look at a map of Iraq, all that out to the west is just empty sand. There's nothing there. There's nothing to conquer. There's no one to conquer, not even Bedouin tribesmen. There ain't a damn thing out there. And they've got, you know, Raqqa, they've got eastern Syria, and they've got, look, I mean, I don't want to play it down too much, Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah, these are cities of millions of people, so it's some pretty significant territory in a sense, but, you know, on the point of whether this represents the rise of a Nazi Reich in the Middle East, it clearly does not. I talked to you a few weeks back about, about that Rand Corporation study. Well, I didn't read the study, but there was an article about it in Politico magazine. I don't know who's the editor there, but they do some pretty decent journalism in there sometimes. Or, I don't know, decent. They do long-form journalism in there. It's not just political gossip crap. They actually do journalism in the Politico magazine. Anyway, so this Rand Corporation guy, with no sense of irony whatsoever, is sounding the alarm that the Islamic State might bring in as many as $2 billion this year. What? Pardon me, did you just say their annual budget for 2014, their annual revenues for 2014, and they don't have bonds to sell or buyers for them willing to buy them on a market? So you're telling me their revenue and outflow this year will be $2 billion? Forgive me if I'm not quaking in my boots. $2 billion. Okay, that makes them the richest terrorist group in the world. Maybe. But it makes them the most pathetic state in the world. I mean, hell, Pango Pango or Central African Republic or one of these completely piece of crap countries have a bigger budget than that. And I don't mean the humans there are pieces of crap. I'm saying the countries are pieces of crap, economically, politically. $2 billion? Oh my God, they're bringing in 2 million a day in black market oil sales. Yeah, they are, huh? Okay. Assuming that's true, watch me not be worried. So, yeah, the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, they aren't. The Nazi Party, they are. Okay? If you want to call them that. Pol Pot is really, and I think this was Coburn as well, comparing them to the Khmer Rouge. They do have sort of that year zero quality. Let's go back to, although they're not really Luddite anti-technologists, but in many ways they're very severe about, you know, living in a 7th century kind of a way, which is a pretty hard sell for people who live in the 21st. But anyway. So yes, they are fanatical Nazi murderers. No, they do not rule anything like a Nazi Germany or pose anything like a Nazi a threat like the Nazis pose to the world, to the people of Europe, and for that matter, Africa and the Middle East. Oh man, you know, I should talk about that in a later segment too. All three of those are really interesting stories. This is Scott Horton Show. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, you know, I mean, this show could be nothing but I told you so's. I've been doing it for so long, and I'm right about every freaking thing. But I first talked with Rand Paul in 2009, the spring of 2009, when he first announced he was running. And I couldn't believe my ears. I've told this story before. Angela Keaton was there. I was in L.A., and when the interview was over, she and I had a discussion about whether maybe we should do this guy a favor and bury this interview and not air it, and maybe try to talk to him about it and see if maybe we could do it again and give him a chance to not be so freaking horrible. And, of course, nah, you know, what are you going to do, man? We went ahead and posted it. But he was bad on Guantanamo, he was bad on Afghanistan, he was bad on prosecuting torturers. He was bad on a couple other things, I forget now. And mostly, he was just bad. You could tell that he had decided, I mean, maybe it's true, he's just a Republican. But at the, you know, the best case, you know, interpretation of it was that if he does believe like his father does, he's already decided he's going to run to the right, to the right, to the right in order to fit in with the Republicans as best he possibly can, and that there's really no line he's not willing to cross. For example, you know, if you're bad on Afghanistan, if you're bad on Guantanamo Bay, then you're bad on anything. You're willing to be bad on anything. And so it was just obvious, like, what his strategy was going to be. It was obvious who he is. That's what he really thought was the best thing. Now, he did win his senator seat, so you got to give him that, I guess. So it worked on the people of Kentucky. But that doesn't make it right. And it doesn't even necessarily make it the right strategy. You want to look at it from a utilitarian point of view. I think he'd be a lot better off if he said, you know, I'm kind of new around here. How about I'll wait and run for president another 4 years? Although then you have the problem of either running against incumbent Hillary or against an incumbent Bush and primarying him. So that could be a problem, you know, Jeb. But anyway, he could just try to focus on being the best damn senator ever and trying to use his bully pulpit in the Senate the way his father did in the House to lead the people of this country to a better frame of mind. So that what we all agree we want is what any president, whether he wins or not, has to give us. We want our Bill of Rights back. We want our military to come home from everywhere. We want to defederalize and demilitarize the police. We want to end the drug war. We want to be a normal country in a normal time. Not an endless state of perpetual emergency and world empire. It's crazy. And it's bankrupting our, certainly our government and our whole society. In so many ways. In fact, there's a nice little side point. The book Pay Any Price by James Risen, it's not so controversial. It's a lot of stuff you know, but it's about the torture and a lot of the other things. And he really, overall, he's making the case that the war on terror has corrupted American society, certainly the American government, basically beyond repair. Everything about it is corrupt, is dishonest, is unlawful, is post-lawful, is what it really is. It's just the will of men, that's all. Running roughshod, doing whatever they want. And it's killing everything. So all Rand Paul has to do, really, is tell the truth and say to the American people, you know, like Bill Hicks would say, you all in your hearts know the arguments here. You know what's true. And you know the whole, all the rest of DC is lying to you. Here's the truth. All empires die. All empires kill themselves. We're not supposed to be an empire. We're supposed to be a limited constitutional republic that defeated an empire and proved for all time that empire is corrupt and empire is destined to fail. That's why the Arabs liked the Americans after World War II. Popular opinion was very pro-American. You guys are the ones who defeated the British and showed that it can be done. The hated British, who invaded almost every country on the face of the planet at one point or another. Really? Go look at the map. There's like 10 countries they've never invaded. Seriously. That's all he has to do is go out there and act like his father. Go out there and give the speech that his father would give on the House floor if he was still there. And help lead America to a better point of view on all of these things. And then it doesn't matter whether it's Jeb or Hillary or whoever we get stuck with. The American people will be insisting on a better agenda. And, you know, I don't know. Whatever. It's all fanciful thinking. But instead, what have we got? We got Rand Paul, who's willing to be nothing but Mitt Romney in order for a chance at the power. And yet, do you guys believe that he's 0.1% more likely to actually achieve the nomination, much less the presidency? Because he's willing to flip-flop on any old thing? Already, if you put in his name and flip-flop, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of results. And from, you know, major papers and so forth. In other words, this is what the journalists, this is becoming the consensus of what they know about him, what they think about him. And that is that he's so ambitious, he will say or do anything to please whoever's listening so that maybe he could have a chance at a little bit more power. He wears it on his sleeve so bad, it's becoming the only thing he's known for, changing his position. When what his father is known for is always being consistent, but it's okay because he's still right. It's not that Ron is so pig-headed he won't ever change his mind about anything. He'd change his mind, it's just he hasn't been wrong. He hadn't been needing correction. He likes to joke that, yes, you know, I am a flip-flopper, I one time changed a position. A serious one, I'm no longer for the death penalty. Because even though I believe that there are some crimes out there that are so horrific that the individual criminal, in fact, does deserve to die, that I don't think anyone should have that authority to carry it out. And I don't think that we can just trust the government to carry it out fairly. And then what does he do? Immediately he cites the racial disparity. For the same kind of crime, a black man is however many huge percentage points more likely to be put to death than a white person who, same bank robbery murder, same murder of their wife, or same whatever it is case. A black man is far more likely to be executed, Ron Paul says, correctly. And he says, so I had to just change that position. That, you know what, it's harder and harder for me to find things that I'm for the government doing. And executing people sure ain't one no more. That's Ron Paul's one and only flip-flop. Which is, it's a joke to call it a flip-flop, right? It gets silly, ironic quotes. That's no flip-flop. That's a decent man getting even better. That's all that is. Try to find me someone saying that about Rand. Racing to get out in front of John McCain on the ISIS war, just so in the campaign season he can say, I'm for that war. I always was. I said that too. And even Justin Raimondo, Rand Paul's biggest fan, had to admit that you can't declare war and then say, but please, no ground troops. That's not how it works. The commander-in-chief is in charge of moving troops, man. Especially when we're getting into a war that anyone can tell in the face of it, the goals cannot be accomplished without putting in American ground troops. I mean, in the short term. Long-term goals cannot be accomplished at all. Not a chance. But rousting them from Mosul, that's going to take the American army.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I can't believe it's already over, man. There's so much more complaining could be done. If anybody wants to call in, I guess we didn't make too much of a call-in show about it. Thanks to Fitzy G for calling. Anybody else wants to get a word in edgewise here? We still got 10 minutes. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And, you know, you can join up the chat room, too. Make a comment, ask a question, whatever you want there, scotthorton.org/chat. And then, yeah, I'm going to take off the rest of the week from the show. I hope that's all right with you guys. But I got some other work I've got to get knocked out here, and it's just very time-intensive stuff I got to get to work on, so I'm going to do that. But I'll still do a Sunday show, I guess, probably. Still do a Sunday show for KPFK, and then I'll be back next week. But, yeah, so, there you go. Yeah, I don't really want to talk about Rand Paul anymore. Let's talk about Michelle Flournoy. Everybody's saying she's going to be the new Secretary of Defense. Chuck Hagel, why he was brought in to wind down the Afghan War. But so much for that, they're going to ramp the Afghan War back up again. And he was there to put a little bit of a right-wing face on, yep, we had to leave Iraq, and I'm a Republican, running the Defense Department, to kind of protect that right flank a little bit, but now we're reinvading Iraq. So now what we need is a real hawk to come in and run the DOD. And so everybody's talking about, oh, let's bring in Michelle Flournoy. Why, what a wonderfully affirmative action thing to do, everyone. It'll make history. She'll be the first female Secretary of Defense. Just like Obama was the first black president, and Hillary Clinton was the third female Secretary of State. And it's so exciting. Or something, right? In other words, the discussion is everybody about who this is everything, it's who this person is. Who cares what her gender is? If we're all feminists here, and we are, and I don't mean in the communist sense, but I mean in the sense that, yes, of course, we all recognize that female humans are also individuals with their own natural rights. That definition of feminist. If we're all feminists here, then what do we care whether Michelle Flournoy is Michael or Michelle? The question is, let's talk about the career of this individual and what this individual hath wrought. Well, she's a big supporter of the Iraq War surge. How's that working out for you? Oh, the surge worked! You know how I know it worked? Because I heard people say the surge worked 150,000 times. And that's the proof that it worked. Now, what was it supposed to accomplish? I have no idea. Did it actually accomplish the things that they said it was going to accomplish? Who the hell knows?
What's a benchmark? I've never even heard of benchmarks before. Are benchmarks part of a surge? Well, I don't know. But you know what I do know? The surge worked. Except then I look at the news and I say, all of Iraq is on fire. Women and babies are being murdered. There's blood flowing in the streets. I think maybe the surge might not have worked. But, you know, she really came to influence after the Iraq War surge under George W. Bush, which she did help to propagandize for and was part of that whole counterinsurgency community then. Michelle Flournoy then became one of the founding leaders just at the very end of the Bush years in preparation for the incoming Democratic administration of Hillary or Obama. They created the Center for a New American Security, which was to be the center-left Brookings Institution-style, Hillary Clinton-style, pro-interventionist, in the name of humanitarian do-gooderism intervention, and in the name of the efficacy of the newly redefined counterinsurgency doctrine of the heroic, magical, saintly even, certainly unquestionable, David Petraeus, the general who taught us all how to chant the surge worked about the Iraq War, and championed implementing that same surge strategy in Afghanistan, even though they're entirely different wars, entirely different situations. In Iraq, America was on the side of the 60% majority and one of the 20% minorities, the Kurds, in their alliance with the Shiite 60% majority against the Sunnis. We were helping the side that was destined to win and didn't even really need our help. And as soon as they were done using up our help, told us to get the hell out. Yeah, nice triumph. But the surge in Afghanistan is to put down the only political representation of the 60% majority, the Pashtuns, who have no other political leadership other than the Taliban. Hamid Karzai's identification as a Pashtun notwithstanding. He doesn't represent them at all, never did. Well, he's out now anyway, but he's been the dictator since 2001 over there until this year. But what you have, and they never talk about this, it's all, the Afghan people this and the terrorists that. But what you have is a sectarian war, same as before. It's the Tajiks and the Hazaras and the Uzbeks, backed by Iran and Russia, against the, and Americans, against the Pashtuns, our old allies that we used to fight against the Communist Northern Alliance and their Iranian and Russian allies back in the Reagan years. And so the surge was not a fait accompli like in Iraq, where they're just coming in to put the finishing touches on the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, get the last few hundred thousand people who need killed dead on behalf of the Bada Brigade and the Ayatollah. In Afghanistan, they were pursuing the exact opposite ends, foisting the minority rule on the majority that had already proven that they're willing to run away and hide and stay and live and fight another day and wait us out. That's all a rebellion, all an insurgency has to do is not lose. And that's what the Taliban has done. And so how do they sell the surge? They said, we are going to, and Michelle Flournoy and her people at the Center for New American Security, they said, we are going to clear, hold, and build. Everywhere the army goes, we're going to create a government in a box that we are going to transmit to and place upon the gratefully willing people of Afghanistan to finally have some competent technocrats running their government. And through this plan, we will change their entire society. That's a real quote. We will change their entire society. We'll go in here and clear and hold and build and counterinsurgency. And so all the infantry are supposed to just stand around like they're traffic cops, like the people of Afghanistan love them, like they expect to be loved, and like they love the Afghans back, and everybody's just going to get along. You're just going to, all day long, you'll just be teaching the people of Afghanistan how and why to love you so much. While at night, the Navy SEALs and the Delta Force will be kicking in doors and killing men in front of their women, in front of their children, and killing the neighbors next door when they come out to see what the hell is going on, and et cetera like that. And then we'll clear, hold, and build their whole damn country. And at the same time, we will and build their society up to where it's a Western European nation state, a democracy with a rule of law and an independent judiciary and a bunch of ridiculousness. And at the same time, we're going to use our SEALs and Delta Force to whoop up on the Taliban so badly that they will crawl with their bloody nose to our table and agree to our terms. We're not going to completely defeat them, but we are going to reduce their power so much that they'll be willing to accept the slightest participation in continued existence and life in Afghanistan after we leave. You know, like Nixon's going to make a deal that keeps the North out of South Vietnam. And yet, they couldn't even get the fake deal. Didn't even happen. They didn't even try. They didn't even bloody the Taliban's nose so bad that they could bring them to the table at all. And like I was mocking them yesterday, and you can read about it in the New York Times, the closest thing they really got to negotiating with the Taliban, it was an imposter the whole time. Just raping them for all the money they took out of your paycheck. Was taking the cash, and he wasn't even a representative of the Taliban at all. This is Michelle Flournoy's catastrophe. That's why Obama's got to escalate the war in Afghanistan now, because Michelle Flournoy lost it. She was the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Policy implementing it. Now she's going to get the top job.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org.